I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a part of diabetes. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program here on AltRightTV.com or WhiteResistanceRadio.com. You can reach us through either portal. I was talking to my friend Brad Love today up in Fort McMurray, and he was telling me about a government program. I'm sorry, not a government program, a program by a local business. And it's called Alpac Lumber, which originally meant Alberta Pacific Lumber Company. And it has it's this program, it's advertised, it was on the radio and the local newspaper, a program to train Aboriginal power engineers. And you might not immediately get what the job is, but it's a good paying job. And it would the power engineers take care of the steam for the plants, the power of the plants up at the oil extraction sites, the oil sands. And a job like this, or the training like this, would be almost a surefire ticket to employment with one of the big, the bigs up there, Syncrude or Suncor. So it's a great opportunity. But it's only for Aboriginals, Indians. And Brad says that, you know, this is an anti-white program. It doesn't give others a chance. It may not necessarily get the best people, or not. It probably won't. But it will definitely discriminate against whites. And here we've got once again, corporations, I don't know what it is about some corporations, they're so eager and willing to throw white workers under the bus. Anyway, Brad is going to complain to the Alberta Human Rights Commission, and he's done this before about other, you know, so-called employment equity or affirmative action programs, and he is usually being told, it's not really discrimination, it's giving these people a hand up. Well, it is discrimination. I think we can all go along with the merit system. You know, the best man or woman gets the job on the basis of qualification. But to say others will not be able to get into this program, it's only for Native Indians, is wrong. Now, the theory when this provision was written into the Charter of Rights and Freedoms back in 1982, it's the most ridiculous, contradictory charter. It says all people are equal. Okay, and they should not be discriminated against on the basis of race, religion, sex. Later on, sexual orientation was added in, and leave out probably language and religion. Okay, that seems straightforward. But then, here's the big kicker. But then, there's an exception made for programs designed to assist people who have been historically disadvantaged. Now, look at 1982. That was a long time ago. It's nearly 40 years ago. To be absolutely mathematically correct, it's 38. You would think, would you not, that in the meantime, that programs for various minorities are being in place to lift them up and so on. At some point, would it not be fair to say, time has run out. These programs, assuming there was ever a reason for them, and I disagree that there was, but at some point, have they not caught up? I mean, must they be given special privileges for, you know, from now until the end of time? As Brad pointed out, these programs are not for white people, and I urge people to protest. If more people did what Brad did, and that is file complaints with the Alberta Human Rights Commission, it would draw attention to this injustice and might even create some pressure. A buddy of his has recently gotten a job on the doing skilled work for the Trans Mountain Pipeline. That's the Keystone Pipeline. And this is a very good job in the oil patch. Anyway, there was an orientation session, and at this orientation session, the new workers or recruits had to listen to an hour and a half of some Aboriginal, Indian, go on and on about historical racism and colonialism and so on. And he said none of this had anything to do with the job at hand. But, and here's the big blackmail, he realized that if he complained or criticized, he might well be told, there's plenty more where you come from. Unemployment in Alberta is very, very high. There's plenty more where you came from. If you're going to object to this, you're out of here. So, would-be employees are forced to listen to mawkish, whining, anti-white propaganda. And, you know, you have to ask, how is this different from communism? In the grim days of communism, both in Eastern Europe and in China, after the workday was over, or at some point even during, workers would be assembled in by the political commissar on the job site to listen to a lecture on Marxism-Leninism or some aspect of communism. The difference was, well, first of all, communism didn't claim to be a democracy. And secondly, most people, as time went on, realized that the communist system was corrupt. In fact, most of what they would be told would be lies. This is a level of knowledge that often present-day workers do not have. That they have not yet understood that they basically are lied to, and they're lied to shamelessly. And that's indeed what's been happening here. Well, reading today's National Post here's yet another scandal, involves a Quebec company called Medicom, and it's been awarded a sole source 10-year, $382 million contract to manufacture N95 masks. Now, you always get a bad feeling when there's a sole source contract. That means there were no competitive bids. How do we know that this company is the best one? Well, if there's no competitive bid, you don't know. It gets worse, though. Even though it does not have a factory in Canada. Now, one of the things we were trying to do after the disaster of the early days of the COVID scandemic, one of the things that we were trying to do was that there was an effort to not depend anymore on communist China, because they sent us some fake face masks that were faulty, but were just plain shoddy and didn't work. Furthermore, the idea that Canada, a major Western country, has to be dependent on a highly unreliable, hostile communist China for key medical equipment, unacceptable. It's not as though, gee, we just don't have the knowledge or the ability to manufacture these things. Of course we do. However, it looks almost as if they couldn't possibly have chosen a worse company. It doesn't have any factories in Canada, and it missed its July deadline for mask delivery for some of the initial masks. So in other words, this sole source company couldn't deliver the goods and doesn't have factories in Canada. You just have to shake your head. Now, the WE charity that I've been talking about from time to time, the brainchild of the Kielberger twin brothers, the information about it just gets worse and worse. It appears that in the time between January and June of this year, they lobbied federal government departments, not once or twice, but 40 or 50 times, letters, personal visits, and so on, we were told that we were not told this even early on in the parliamentary hearings. The Kielbergers were all over Ottawa, or at least their organization was. Clearly lobbying, hustling one project or another, even though they'd not registered as lobbyists. You know, they share the same entitled worldview as the trust fund kid, our prime minister. Anyway, along the way, we said it was going to repay the over $30 million the government had advanced them. In fact, some of the money was given to we even before the government signed the contract. So connected are these people, or so privileged. Well, anyway, the question was asked at a parliamentary committee this past week. Well, has we, followed through on its promise to repay the money that it was given? And see, the contract fell apart, so, the minister in charge, and you shake your head. Her name is Bardish Jagger. That's a female. So Bardish heads up something called the Ministry for Diversity, Inclusion, and Youth. You see, the program was supposed to deliver over $900 million for a summer project to recruit young people, I think from 16 to 30, to do volunteer work, for which they would be paid $10 an hour. And I can already hear you say, wait a sec, I mean, isn't volunteer work free? I mean, volunteer? Yeah. I mean, it was a cockamamie plan from the beginning. But anyway, it has since been cancelled. Okay, so fair question to the Minister of Diversity, Inclusion, and Youth. You talk about mad virtue signaling. What do you even mean? Anyway, Minister for Diversity, Inclusion, and Youth, Bardish Jagger, she was asked, well, have they repaid? Have they repaid the $30 million yet? Wasn't sure. She didn't know. And it turns out they hadn't yet. I said at the time, that this is only a few days ago, whatever happened to the ability of her or one of her underlings to pick up the phone and say, and phone the Kielbergers at We Charity and say, we're going to be sending a courier over to pick up the check for $30 million. Please have it ready by close of business today. I mean, wouldn't that be the way it would be normally done? Instead, although the whole We project collapsed over a month ago, that the monies apparently have not been forthcoming. And this letter writer, Henry Koza, writing to the National Post today, says, was sending a check too complicated or something? I have never heard of any government anywhere of whatever ideological stripe ever being unable to accept cash transfers in any form and at any time. The beyond lame alibis provided for nothing having been done is just mind-boggling. Well, I'd like to turn to a brief commentary by Tucker Carlson, and it's an issue I raised yesterday about this horrible case of the little five-year-old boy in North Carolina shot in the head by a Negro neighbor because the child had allegedly driven his bicycle over a corner of the Negro's lawn, and the little child was shot and killed in front of his two sisters. This is little Cannon Hinnant, and this is Tucker Carlson's concert.
Murder of a 5-year-old boy last week in North Carolina.
5-year-old Kenan Hennins was riding his bike outside of his Wilson, North Carolina home over the weekend when police say a neighbor, 25-year-old Darius Sessom, came out and shot him in the head.
Kenan was the kind of kid that was always polite.
You just could not help but be changed when you met Kenan.
Really, everybody just wants answers, you know, for why this was done.
Kenan's father is confused by his son's murder, saying there's no explanation for why Sessoms would target his son.
There was never anything between me and him, any bad blood whatsoever.
It's really beyond. The suspect has been charged with first-degree murder. The question is, why haven't the media covered this story? What about it don't they like? Nancy Grace is a host on Fox Nation. She joins us. Nancy, thanks so much for coming on. Make sense of this, if you would,
for
us.
Thank you for inviting me. Well, you know what? When you put the picture up just then of Kenan Hennins, just 5 years old. By the way, he was set to start kindergarten this week. And I think back on my children, as you know, then John, David, and Lucy, when they went to kindergarten, and what a big day it was. And now he's gone forever. And you're right. This case has not been covered, and I wonder why, too. This is what I know. I know that the families were friends. There had never been any bad blood between them at all. Now, according to family members, the motive was that this little boy, it was a Sunday afternoon, 5:30, broad daylight. They had gone to church. They had gone to lunch. They were out in the yard playing. The little boy rode his bike into the neighbor's yard. And the defendant, according to eyewitnesses, multiple eyewitnesses, 25-year-old Darius Sessoms, comes out, holds the gun up, and shoots the child point blank in the head. I predict this will be a death penalty case.
I've said many times, and I mean it, that I don't think you should draw broad societal conclusions from a single horrific crime. The media specializes, obviously, in that, and some of those conclusions are misleading, if not lies. But to ignore something completely, and they ignore murders, by the way, every day on the south side of Chicago as well, you really get the feeling that news coverage is guided purely by political imperatives. Purely.
Well, it seems to me that right now, with the concern of...
And that was, I thought, an extremely good commentary about this. Just shocking murder of a little boy. And apparently, and I believe I mentioned this last night, the father and the next door neighbor who's being charged had eaten together the night before. There's something profoundly messed up about this, the lack of interest of the lamestream media is shocking. Here's a little bit closer to home in Ontario, a commentary by an Ontario man about the so-called COVID virus, this lockdown pandemic, scandemic that we're now living through. For some reason, is a little slow in picking up here. I will try to play a little differently for you. More and more is coming out about just the shocking lack of medical science backing up government positions. Wild predictions based on computer modeling. So we're going to have, we may have a second surge of the virus, we're told, in the fall. And a very observant person I know pointed out, well, wait a sec, every fall, you get into the winter season, or getting to cold weather, there is flu, yes. That doesn't mean there are people are about to die in the streets. So I'm going to try to play this commentary now.
Here we are in August 2020, a full 6 months after the declaration of the state of emergency in Ontario, 6 months after the declaration of the COVID pandemic. And I think it's time that we compare what we've seen 6 months later from what we were told to expect back in March. Back in March, we were told that we could expect 100,000 deaths in Ontario. And this justified the state of emergency, this dire prediction. In fact, we have had 2,800 deaths in Ontario. Over 1,800 of those deaths have been in long-term care. That's the fact as compared to the prediction, right? We can also look at the other numbers, and maybe we will in a bit, but one of the other numbers is that 37,000 people who have tested positive for COVID have also recovered. Many of them didn't even know they had COVID, or their symptoms were so mild they were confused with a cold or other minor symptoms. Those are facts. Another fact is we have a lot of people who are scared. That's a fact. I've talked to them. Indeed, I think there's people out there, many people, who are so terrified of contracting COVID that they limit how often they will go outside. They limit their interactions with other people. That's a fact. We also know that in Ontario, we've made masks mandatory in just about every community, even though we've had less than 1,000 deaths outside of long-term care, which is on par with a regular flu season. Our hospitalizations are on par with a regular flu season. Everything that we know about hospitalizations, about recovery, about fatalities with COVID are generally the same or very similar to what we experience every year in Ontario with every flu season. Those are facts. The predictions that justified the closure of our economy, that justified the closure of our healthcare system, the predictions that shut down our social interactions, none of those predictions have actually become true. The facts are very different from the predictions. But here's another fact. The fact is that there are still many people who are fearful. Maybe they haven't seen the facts on mortality. Maybe they haven't seen the facts on recovery. Maybe they haven't had the opportunity to compare this year with previous years. And they're hearing mostly the continued and the relentless headlines about COVID. and not having the opportunity to peel back the layers of headlines and get into the data, the evidence, and the reality. Many people have asked me why are we continuing with this excessive restrictions and lockdowns on our education system, our healthcare, our economy, our social interactions? And in short, a lot can be attributed to public opinion. I can tell you this, there's very, very few elected politicians who are speaking out, or even, I would say, even inquiring as to, is our response to COVID proportionate? Is it reasonable? Is it responsible? They're fearful of speaking out because of peer pressure. They're fearful of speaking out because of perceptions of public backlash and opposition. And that is true. There is no question in my mind that there are many elected people who are following public opinion instead of discharging their duties as leaders in their communities, of standing up, speaking out, and ensuring our policies are proportionate and reasonable. I know there's many people who view COVID in a similar fashion to me, that its effects and its consequences are not dissimilar to what we see each and every year in this country and in our province. And they're wondering, how did we get here? And more importantly, how do we get out of this? And it comes down very simple. Politicians follow public opinion. If you're at home and you're wondering what you can do to influence our policies, what you can do to end these excessive restrictions, what you can do to end these mandatory masks, well, you can take part in public opinion. You can take part in democracy. How many of people watching this have picked up the phone and called the Premier's office, have called the Minister of Health? How many have written a letter to the Premier, to the Minister of Health? How many have written a letter to your own member of provincial parliament? How many have written a letter to their town council? That's how democracy works. It's a two-way street. People need to be engaged. People need to be involved. And if you believe the facts rather than the predictions, if you recognize that the policies 6 months later are not proportionate to the risk, if you're concerned when this state of emergency is going to be over, or if it will be over, you can make that change. Pick up the phone the Premier, pick up the phone the Minister of Health, write a letter to your local Member of Parliament. These are all things that we must do if we want to be influential, if we want to take part in a democracy. It's no good just sitting down on the computer and making a comment on Facebook or on Instagram. It's not bad, but it's not going to have the effect that you want. You need to be engaged. You need to be involved. You need to tell elected members what it is that you expect. Because I know.
That was a commentary by independent Ontario MPP Randy Hillier. This is an excellent...
I must confess I was feeling intellectually lonely until I read a piece today by my colleague Andrew Bolt. Thank goodness for you, Andrew. Here we are with alarmist political behaviour everywhere, leading to alarmist headlines. Victoria now in official state of disaster. Why? 671 new cases yesterday and 7 more deaths. Don't you love it? New cases. Let's deal with the deaths. You know my view, anyone's death diminishes us all. But I've scrutinised the World Health Organization figures for today, midday. We have 43 people, serious or critically ill. 1% of all cases Australia-wide, 43. And yes, there were 7 deaths on Sunday. 3 women in their 70s, a man and a woman in the 90s, all in nursing homes. They're not deaths from COVID. They tested positive, but there were other preconditions. And Victoria had 400 excess deaths in the month of April. That is 400 more than the usual number for April, 400. The total deaths to date from coronavirus, 221. Yet we have a state of disaster. Our job recovery's gone backwards. Oh, the New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian, she kicks in, continues to alarm us. The next few weeks will make or break us. If lockdowns were the answer, why do these deaths continue to escalate? And for 221 deaths and 43 people currently serious, out of a national population of 25 million people, why have we filled Australia with fear and alarmism? The consequences on personal well-being, business viability, the national economy and mental health, the consequences are far beyond what could be described as responsible management of the situation. Back to Andrew Bolt briefly, where he wrote today, and I've been saying this for months, but I quote Andrew, there's a better way to save lives and save the economy from certain disaster. Victoria, don't accept this. There's a better and cheaper way to save the state and the country. And he goes on to make the point that I've made. Look after the vulnerable. Most of them are in aged care. And as Andrew Bolt brutally states, 40% of aged care home residents die within 9 months. So Victoria's bans are doing huge damage, essentially to save aged care residents from dying a few months earlier. Sensible older people are quarantining at home. I said last week we followed lemming-like. First, alarmist so-called health experts, who seem to know nothing and care little for the economic consequences of what they're advocating, and politicians and the media follow on with the same alarmism. And here we are, swimming in debt. Kids are not at school, people are locked up. The mental anguish of this is beyond calculation. Which brings me to Professor James Allen. Professor James Allen is a Canadian-Australian law professor, the Garrick Professor of Law at the University of Queensland. He wrote recently that nothing has changed his mind since he made earlier comments in April. Quote, what I said back then, I'll repeat now. In a decade, this will be looked back on as one of the most colossal public policy fiascos of the century, unquote. And referring to the recipe followed by, quote, virtually all Western governments, he said you'll have, quote, some combination of the following. Shut down businesses, the bureaucratic political complex deems inessential. Indulge in extraordinary inroads into people's civil liberties. Don't trust average citizens, but turn the police into an arm of the nanny state. Lock down huge chunks of the productive economy. Pay, now he says, make that overpay, all sorts of people to do nothing at all, while having no plausible, politically palatable route out of that situation. And in doing all of that, become the biggest government spenders of virtually all time, saddling the next generation with untold debts and making Gough Whitlam green with jealousy. Wrote Professor Allen, and I quote, this is the sort of package policies you might unleash when faced with the 14th century Black Death, which is estimated to have killed from a third to half of Europe's population. By contrast, he says, the American Centre for Disease Control estimates the infection fatality rate of coronavirus about 0.26%. To put that in contrast, a bad flu season kills about 0.24% of the people who catch it, and we don't annihilate the economy over that. Quote, he says, to put it in further contrast, 161,000 or so Aussies die every year in this country. I might add that's about 440 a day. But writes Professor Allen, between 1,000 and 1,500 die of the flu. We so far have had 221 deaths, and that figure includes those who've died with the virus, as well as those who've died from it, 221. But 1,200, writes Professor Allen, die in car accidents. And as Professor Allen says, as of writing, the Wuhan COVID flu has not cracked the top 50 causes of death in this country. Writes Professor Allen, all of that explains why the press, which has been a Pravda-like supporter of lockdowns and medical bureaucracies, hate Sweden. You see, Sweden didn't lock down or shut down any businesses or drive a truck through civil liberties. It gave its citizens advice, trusted them, and then tried to protect the elderly and the frail. Let me just say here that I can hear the Morrisons of this world saying that there were thousands of deaths in Sweden, 5,619 to be exact. But as Professor Allen says, in terms of deaths per million, Sweden's deaths have been fewer than Belgium, the UK, Spain and Italy. Or put in terms the fearmongers in Australia can grasp, 99.95% of Swedes have not died of the coronavirus. For those Swedes under 60, 99.998% have not died. As Professor Allen says, to sum this up using a concept of the philosophy of the mind, this massive overreaction and love of lockdowns is bonkers and a monumental screw-up, his words. And in this, what a bet whether the response would have been less draconian had every politician and bureaucrat had to take a 20% cut if businesses were shut down. As Professor Allen writes, no skin in the game, readers, that they can afford to pretend that the deaths from corona do count in any calculation, that the deaths caused by the lockdown, suicides, more cancer from less screening, all the devastation in the third world from the ruined global economy, deaths from a ruined economy here, they don't count. Writes Professor James Allen, in my view, politicians should be looking at massive pay cuts now. Ditto civil servants. Ditto the ABC. And he says the pay cuts should stay until we return to normal unemployment rates and are paying off the debt. Or as I've said, until they've satisfactorily addressed the calamity that they have created. Well, Professor James Allen joins me from Brisbane. Professor, you and I are on the one page here, as is my colleague Andrew Bolt. Time to change strategy, don't you reckon?
Well, first of all, welcome to TV and congratulations on the move from Radio Island. Guess we're in a bit of a minority on this one, I have to say.
I know, but as you say, in a decade this will be looked back on as one of the most colossal public policy fiascos of the century.
Well, it seems like that to me. There's 44 million Americans out of work. We know that the unemployment rate, the real unemployment rate in Australia is 15 or 20%. There's what, I think some 3,400 ICU beds in Victoria, and I think well under 100 are actually being used. We started off with a plan to flatten the curve, and somehow it transmogrified into some sort of pseudo-eradication policy. You know, we're trying to emulate Japan in the 17th century. It's just, you know, I don't see it working.
How do we recover from this? As you say, a shutdown in essential businesses, but of course that's determined by bureaucrats and politicians, or indulge in extraordinary inroads into people's civil liberties, will we ever get them back? And then don't trust average citizens and turn the police into an arm of the nanny state, lock down huge chunks of the productive economy, pay all sorts of people, as you say, to do absolutely nothing, and no palatable route out of the situation, and then become the biggest government spenders of all time. I mean, for a fatality rate, little different from a bad flu season. Who is advising the government?
I don't know. I mean, think back to the 1968-69 Hong Kong flu. A million people died around the world. 100,000 Americans, which if you make a ratio with population, is pretty much how many have died now. They didn't even cancel the Woodstock concert. Lord Sumption, who was a recently retired top British judge, who's also on our side of this argument, he said this is the greatest infringement on our civil liberties in history. And he's refusing to abide by the rules. So this is a retired equivalent of the top court. He's just saying, I'm not going to do it. So far, they haven't given him a ticket or arrested him.
That's
but, you know, I know I came here, I thought there was supposed to be these larrikins with a real sense of anti-authoritarian streak. Actually, it looks like some pretty supine, docile people.
Quite amazing, isn't it? I mean, as you say, the coronavirus hasn't cracked the top 50 causes of deaths in this country, and it's easier
to... That was as of a few weeks ago.
Thereabouts. I mean, for God's sake, I was checking the figures today. Look, Professor, thank you for your time, thank you for your courage, thank you for your scholarship. A Garrick Professor of Law, we don't listen to him, of course, at the University of Queensland.
And that was Alan Jones with a very, very good take on the coronavirus.
Folks, I'm about to share.
This is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side. I'm going to take a somewhat shorter musical break tonight, and I'm going to play some tunes by Alan Jacks. By Randy Travis. And I'm going to start with one that I think is just so moving. It's Three Wooden Crosses. It's a ballad with a real lesson to it. Randy is a very religious man, and overcame a brush with the law and drinking problems, and he's just a first-rate person and a great singer.
Three wooden crosses.
cross is on the right side of the highway.
Randy Travis. Well, that's a good song, but we've already heard that, so we'll go play some more here.
Suppose I called you up tonight and told you that I love you, and suppose I said I want to come back home, and suppose I cried and said I think I finally learned my lesson, and I'm tired of spending all my time alone. If I told you that I realize you're all I ever wanted, and it's killing me to be so far away, would you tell me that you love me too, and would we cry together, or would you simply laugh at me and say, would you simply laugh at me and say, asking me to take you in.
Randy Travis, and this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. Back with you again tomorrow, and I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours, which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the Maple Leaf forever.